Okay, and Jim prayed, and we prayed with him that we might be studying these things to better equip us to teach others. Of course, that would involve us in what's often called debate. Is that a Christian thing to do?
Yes.
Yes, it is. Jesus was continually involved in debate, wasn't he? The apostles were continually involved in debate. And sometimes it didn't turn out very pretty, but they did it anyway. But an added advantage, of course, is to strengthen us in our faith, not our faith party type faith, but the faith that we want to be sure is based upon the Word of God. And so hopefully this quarter in the study of a very popular but erroneous movement, the charismatic movement, has been of some benefit in that regard. Open your Bibles to Acts 2. We're looking at arguments that are made by those in the charismatic movement to justify their views. We continue that study today. Anyone need a copy of week 12? Okay. And we're looking at today number 6. In Acts 2 and verse 4, what day is this? Pentecost. Why is it significant to know that in a study of the charismatic movement? That's right. They call it the Pentecostal movement or the Pentecostal experience. That's right. Wednesday night we had two men, you may have met them, visiting with us. They're from the United Pentecostal Church, where you get this Pentecostal idea, because of what they think people experienced on the day of Pentecost. Now, in Acts 2:4, some did experience the ability to speak in tongues, it says, verse 4. They were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other tongues. In verse 11, we hear them speak in our tongues. You know that the word tongues here refers to languages. And how do you know? The nations are listed. The intervening verses make that clear, do they not? Verse 6, they were hearing them speak in his own language. Verse 8, his own language to which we were born. Verse 11, as Jim has pointed out, these various nations, we hear them in our own tongues or languages. So what happened on Pentecost, whoever received the power to experience speaking in tongues, which we have stated is the apostles, that's that group of men, it was a speaking in an intelligible language. When people talk about the gift of tongues today, however, sometimes, in fact, every time, it's unintelligible gibberish, isn't it? And to justify that, they say that 1 Corinthians 12, if they don't argue that Acts 2 is unintelligible, which they may do that as well, but in 1 Corinthians 12, 13, and 14, where Paul discusses spiritual gifts, some will argue that the tongues being spoken of are defined in this context in chapter 13, verse 1, to be the tongue of angels, the language of angels. It's sometimes called the heavenly language, the language that's spoken in heaven by God and the angels. Because he said, if I speak with the tongues of men and of angels. And so some may say, don't know what the one you'd be talking to might say. They might say, see, the tongues of 1 Corinthians 13, even if I grant Acts 2 as a human language, this is different. This is the tongue of angels. In chapter 14, verse 2, they would argue that nobody understands it. See that verse 2? Speaks in a tongue. no one understands. We've already discussed that previously. The tongue speaker understands it. No one else understands it, not because it's the tongue of angels, but because it's a foreign language. Without an interpreter, they do not understand it. But that's another verse that's appealed to. And so we make some observations about that particular concept. First of all, the word translated tongues in Acts 2, so hold your finger here at Acts 13 and 14. Go back to Acts 2. And verse 4, the word translated tongues there, the word translated tongues in verse 11. Those two verses is exactly the same word in their language. And you see, I've got the verses on your sheet here. As 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 10, interpretation of tongues, verse 28, tongues, verse 30, do not speak with tongues, do they? Same word as 13:1, 13:8, where he says tongues will cease. Same word as 14, verse 2, 4, and 5. So first of all, it is the same word. Can a same word have different meanings in different places, however? It can. All we're observing is that when Luke wrote Acts and Paul wrote Corinthians. And so Paul wrote Corinthians when? About. 57. About 57. Luke wrote Acts when? About. 61 and 63, right? Probably closer to maybe 63, somewhere along in there. It's right in that time frame. So, 57 to 63, you're talking about 6 years. We're not talking about 100 years difference in these letters. 6 years. Same territory, country. Were Luke and Paul, did they ever meet one another?
Yes.
Certainly, they traveled together, didn't they? So here's Luke wrote this letter, Paul wrote this letter. Within about 6 years of one another, they use the same word, that much we know. Okay? So, we've already observed in Acts 2 the evidence in the context. You don't have to know one letter of Greek to know that the tongues of verse 4 and 11 in Acts 2 are human languages. All you've got to do is read the context. In 1 Corinthians 12 through 14, you can know that's a human language. Look in chapter 14, verse 21. In the law it is written, by men of strange tongues and by the lips of strangers I will speak to this people, even so they will not listen to me. So then tongues are for a sign. Now, where does that quote in verse 21 come from? Isaiah, that's right. And what was it talking about, the tongue of strangers? That's right, a foreign nation that was going to capture Israel or Judah. That's right. And that's what he's talking about. And so it's not heavenly language in that verse. It's the tongue of another nation, the language of another nation. So again, you have to know nothing about Greek. All you have to do is read the context and let the writer tell you what he's talking about. And so in Acts 2, we know it's human languages. In 1 Corinthians 14, we know it's human languages. And so this idea has no support, really. Interestingly, in 1 Corinthians 13, if I argue with you and I say, see, this is the tongue of angels, without leaving the verse, what weakness in my argument have you noticed? Not even leaving verse 1. If tongues of angels means language angels speak, then what in that phrase? Huh? That's true, you're just making noise. Tongues of what?
Men.
So what does that mean? If tongues of angels means language angels speak, what do tongues of men mean? Language men speak. Why don't they ever mention that? Why is that skipped? Of course, that's not the point. Tongues of angels is not talking about language angels speak. But I'm just saying it's interesting that in a phrase, tongues, with two phrases that modify, one is selected to make a point and the other is ignored. Isn't that interesting? Tongues of men and of angels. And we've already noticed in chapter 14 that this is a language men speak. Why did he call it the tongue of angels then? Look at Psalm 78:25. If, I don't know how good this illustration is, but let's try it. You probably think of a better one. Fella comes in with a new suit. Boy, it's a classy suit. You can tell this is high dollar. Say, man, I tell you what, that's a Cadillac. What do you mean?
Top of the line.
Top of the line. You don't mean it's an automobile that bears the emblem Cadillac. But there's an association, a word association like that. It's an idiom that we use in our language. In Psalm 78:25, man did eat the bread of angels. He's talking about the manna in the wilderness. He sent them food in abundance. The manna, was it the food angels ate? No, the food men ate. Food of angels. An excellent food. It's a way that they would bring something to another level. If they wanted to talk about a mountain being a great mountain, they might say, that's mountain of God. Mountain of God, what is that? God live it? No. It's just a way in their language, it's an idiomatic way of saying most excellent, excelling. And here you can clearly see use bread of angels without meaning bread angels ate, but a most excellent food provided by God from heaven, and that would sustain them for 40 years in the wilderness, provide every bit of nourishment they needed, every bit, with this one simple food. Amazing food that was indeed. Look at Acts chapter 6 and verse 15. You know, if you could develop a food today, one cracker, that would give you all your food groups, every mineral, every vitamin you needed, sustain you, satisfy your hunger. Could you get rich? Wouldn't that be amazing? That's what that manna was. Food of angels. Here's Acts 7:15 by Stephen. When he was in a debate defending the truth of the gospel. It says, fixing their gaze on him, all who were sitting in the council saw his face like the face of an angel. What does an angel's face look like?
Never saw
him. Do angels have bodies? They're spirits. Well, what's he talking about the face of an angel? His countenance was something exceptional, something unusual. And that's an idiomatic way of saying that. And it may be that that's exactly what's being done in 1 Corinthians 13. If I speak with the tongues of men, but if this is the most excellent, because the Spirit empowers you, and of angels, most excellent language, whichever language He gives you. You can speak it perfectly. You can get the right verbs and the right adjectives and the right objects, and you can put it together because the Spirit's giving it to you. But you don't have love. You're nothing. So you can speak most excellently. But if love is not the controlling and motivating factor, you're nothing. Now that's a lesson about spiritual gifts, but it's certainly a lesson to us who speak and teach today. We may be great orators, few of us, I'm not in that class, but they have some great men who are very excellent speakers. But if love does not motivate, drive, and control them, then all their labors are for nothing so far as they're concerned. All right, so we just suggest that as a possible explanation of that phrase. You can study that. Yes?
As we're prone to do, sometimes we give in to the argument before the argument's been made. And that strikes me about tongues of angels, unless I'm missing something somewhere. If the explanation of tongues of angels, and I understand that if you try to pin that on, it's not understandable. But you can debunk that when you look at the context of 1 Corinthians 14. So where is your basis for this tongue of angels, even if I grant it is a language of angels? Where's your basis that it's not understandable? Where's your basis that it's different than the English language or the Greek language or whatever language is understandable? Where's the basis? It's not there. I don't know of any place that the angels spoke in tongues in a non-understandable language. Every time angels ever talked, of course, that I'm aware of, they came as messengers of some sort, and they were very understandable.
All right, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. Even if you grant it the tongue of angels, what makes us think they speak in a language that's unintelligible to man? That's kind of assumed, isn't it? And that's a good point. Good point Wally makes.
Cornelius was able to understand.
Right. And that's what Wally's saying. Every time you have it, of course, they're speaking to men, so not naturally they would use man's language. But let's say, yeah, but the tongue angels used to talk to angels is different. Where's your proof? To state it doesn't prove it. And that's what's being assumed, as Wally well pointed out. All right, number 7. Miracles are needed today because people still have problems. You'll note down on your lesson I have on, I think it's your third bullet point, sometimes Jesus, no, that's not it. That's the opposite. Okay. We've got some verses here. Jesus worked miracles because of His love for people and compassion with their needs. Is that correct?
Yes.
That is correct. So sometimes He did do what He did out of compassion and out of concern for people's dilemma. But the argument is God still loves people and He's compassionate. And He shows no respect of persons. Does Acts 10, 34 and 35 say God is no respecter of persons? Does it? It does, doesn't it? That phrase is there. And so, He must still work miracles. Therefore, when people today have problems and needs, illness, financial debts, lack of job, etc., they are right to expect God to work a miracle. Let's suppose you believe that for just a moment. You believe that sincerely, regardless of what the Bible teaches. What dilemma are you going to face somewhere down the road, Mark?
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. You say, uh-oh. Is God not hearing my prayer? Or is everything I've read and been taught wrong? Is the Bible even true? people who wake up this morning still in their shoes, who believed Mr. Camping. What problem have they got about the world was going to end yesterday? See? Either it was all a fraud, or the Bible's not. He said the Bible taught this. He's in the paper over and over again. I read he's a biblical scholar. How can you argue with a biblical scholar, an engineer? Well, Wally sent me a link to an article I was reading. The true quote-unquote believer, they just excuse it. That's amazing what we'll do in religion. Just excuse it. And go on. Instead of saying, yeah, I see this guy was a false prophet, or some unfortunate going to reach the conclusion, and that's what infidels do. The devil loves it. The whole thing's a fraud. And that's what happens with this movement. When people see it's all fraudulent, they figure that's the way it was in the Bible times. And so these are serious mistakes, mistakes that have some very practical consequences. So let's look at what we have here about answering this particular point.
Steve, please. I have a question. I didn't understand what you meant when you were talking about Acts 10, 34 and 35, that you said, can you go back and repeat what you said about that he's...
Remember, this is their argument. We're looking at their argument. I'm explaining their argument. They say God used miracles, Christ used miracles because of his love and compassion for people. That's true.
What was that about the respect that he didn't respect?
Acts 10:34. Look at Acts 10:34. I most certainly understand how God is not one, this version says, one to show partiality or to show respect of persons. And so their argument is, if God worked a miracle on a sick person back then to give them health because of compassion, he doesn't respect persons. He doesn't show partiality. So if you got a sick person today and God's still that kind of God, he's going to heal that sick person. Otherwise, he's a respecter of persons. He's partial. He heals that sick person, but he don't heal that sick person. To show respect, to do something for one person that you wouldn't do for another because of your attitude toward them, for example.
Partiality.
Respect of persons. The idea of well, respect of persons, the way the King James, maybe the New King James translates it, right? That's the way the King James translates it. You might got New King James, that's the way it translates it, right? This one says show, sir?
I think American Standard
did. Respect of persons. This one says show partiality. And maybe that's a good indication of why the translator translated, because it may give us a little hesitation in our terminology. But showing respect of persons, if there was only one hamburger left that you had cooked, and Craig was hungry and I was hungry, who'd get it if you had the deciding vote?
Craig!
You would be showing respect of persons. See? And rightfully so. And rightfully so. So, okay, so...
Steve?
Yes. Okay, and and I'm going to get to this a little bit later in these points. We study the Bible, sometimes we're not careful like making quilts. When a person makes a quilt, or used to, I don't know how they do it now. I know like my mother made quilts, and I think Sister Wilbur made quilts. They'd get a scrap of piece of material here and a scrap of piece of material there, and they didn't have to be alike. They didn't have to be necessarily even the same kind of material, just different scraps of material. Sew them together and make this quilt. And not necessarily harmony and color, design, whatever. And so here's a verse that says God worked miracles out of compassion. Matthew 14, Matthew 15. Here's another piece. Here's another patchwork over here that says God's no respecter of persons. Stick those two together. But we're going to demonstrate in a moment that this patch from Acts 10 has nothing to do with working miracles, healing people. And so that may be fine in making quilts, but it's not a way to study the Bible. And we need to be careful of that. I see we as speakers, we want to teach on something. We already got mine where we want to teach on. So I get my concord and say, oh, there's a verse with that word in it. Oh, here's another one with that word in it. We stick them together. Maybe they have nothing to do with one another or what you're talking about. But boy, we've got verses to support our point. Be careful of that kind of thing. Because while we may not teach anything seriously in error, that kind of thinking paves the way for this kind of error. Okay? So, yes. Who? Mike? You had a comment? Y'all know what Mike's talking about? Go ahead and develop that, Mike. Speak up.
Well, the liar be killed. So there'd be no liars.
If people tried to lie about their giving or lie to God about their lives, boy, I'll tell you what, churches throughout the land would be a lot smaller, wouldn't they? And so that's a good point Mike makes. And he struck Ananias and Sapphira dead. But he doesn't do that with everybody. Yes, Betty?
When you mentioned prayer a while ago, I know we don't have miracles today like we used to, but, you know, when you pray to God, if, say, someone is sick, he could heal them, and, you know, that's kind of, you know, a miracle, but it's not like they're speaking of today.
Right, it's not a miracle in the sense of in the hands of men. How God does that, we'll talk about that in a little bit. He may use providence. He may cause you to. Have you ever just been searching for some remedy for something, and by coincidence somebody mentioned something to you, or you run across a particular doctor treatment that was helpful, and you wonder, how did I ever? And that was interesting. And there's divine providence. And sometimes God may do things, and we don't know how it happened, but sometimes people are just better. So I do believe God's working to help people today, but not putting miracles in the hands of men to do that. Mike, you had another comment. That's a good point, Betty. Speak up.
Parallel with this one, love speak of compassion, no respecter, in James 1, 26 and 27. We can't apply that logic, you know, as it's applied today to those verses of James. God does love all widows and orphans, but it better open up the avenue that some would choose to open up, just because those individual aspects of that statement are true, that would apply it.
Okay, good point. And there is a preference that's indicated in Galatians 6:10, isn't there? As far as doing good, especially to the household of faith. And that's a good point that Mike makes. Okay, so here in answer to this, in the first century, were miracles used to solve all the problems that people had or to meet all their needs? And I've given you a number of examples. Let's go through these quickly. What shows in Philippians 2 that that was not the case? Verse 26 and 27, if you've already looked up these verses and written down your answers. If you've already looked at these verses and written down your answers, what in Philippians 2 shows that? If you look at the answers you wrote down on your sheet when you looked up this verse and studied for the class, what is the reason from Philippians chapter 2, verse 26 and 27?
He allowed someone to be
That's right. Epaphroditus was so sick, he nearly died. That's right. What is the situation in 1 Timothy 5:23 that shows that even in the first century, miracles didn't solve all of people's health problems? Timothy was told to take a little wine for his stomach's sake. Why didn't Paul just tell him, when I get there, I'm going to lay hands on you and I'll be okay? And why didn't he do it when he's traveling with him? What about 2 Timothy 4:20? Trophimus was left sick, wasn't he? 2 Corinthians 12, 7 through 9. What?
Have a problem.
What kind of problem? I tried it. We don't know. It's called a thorn in the flesh. Did Paul pray about it?
Yes.
He did. But this proves that God did not use miracles to solve every health issue or problem that people had. These verses show that. And in 1 Thessalonians, Paul needs to labor night and day. He might say, I'm poor. And of course, these health and wealth preachers say, you just need to pray and send me some money, some seed money, of course. You always got to send that seed money. But Paul, I guess, didn't know one of these evangelists because he had to labor night and day. 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians. Philemon 18, here's a fellow who had a debt. And he became a Christian. Did he still have the debt?
Yes.
Who did he owe it to? Another Christian. But the debt was still in place. Being a Christian didn't relieve his debts. 2 Corinthians 8, 2, the Macedonians, he said they were so poor. I never expected them to give like this. And they were committed to the Lord, he said. They first gave themselves to the Lord, but they're still poor. And in Revelation 2:10, both verse 9 and verse 10, about the church in Smyrna, he said, what does he know about them in verse 9? Your tribulation and what? Your poverty. Who knows that? Who said, I know about your poverty? Jesus Christ said, I know about your poverty. Not only that, he said in verse 10, what was going to happen to them? They were going to suffer. Some were going to be cast into prison. Some might even die. But he didn't avert all of that. So we've got to look for some other reason why miracles were worked in the first century. God did have the power to keep people from suffering, to get people out of prison. Did he get Peter out of prison? Yes. He did have the power to keep people from dying or to bring them back from death, didn't he? Yes. Yes. He extended Hezekiah's life 15 years, didn't he? So, why didn't he do that to everybody? Was he a respecter of persons? No, he wasn't. Acts 10 says he's not, which leads us to what we'll look at here in just a moment. Miracles throughout biblical history were used by God when no human need or problem was solved. And I've given you some examples. In Exodus chapter 4, 1 through 9, what were miracles used for in that text? Was somebody sick? Was somebody poor and they were given wealth? What was the purpose of the miracles there?
Give Moses the signs that he would show the people when he needed to convince them he was from God.
Right. Give Moses a sign to show the people he was from God, that he was God's prophet. Had nothing to do with somebody being sick or poor or in prison, except that Moses would be their deliverer, but that wasn't the purpose of that miracle. Number 17. What kind of miracle happened there? Aaron's rod blossomed. What was the purpose of that?
Show God's choices
to who would be the high priest, right? wasn't because they couldn't grow crops and so he made the rod blossom so they could pick fruit off of it, was it? No. 1 Kings 18, 30 through 39, Elijah worked a miracle. What kind of miracle was it? Or at least God, in answer to his prayer, worked a miracle. What? That's right. Fire from heaven burned up the sacrifice after they put water over everything. And again, to confirm Elijah as the prophet of God. Matthew 14, 22 through 23, what miracle did Jesus perform there in the presence of his disciples? Walking on the water. Didn't heal a sickness. Didn't solve poverty. Right? Didn't cause the government organization to show equality. And so miracles, people assume the purpose of miracles. We just read the Bible, we'll see that these kind of conclusions are not correct. Sometimes Jesus refused to work miracles to meet a human need. In Matthew 4, 1 through 7, what human need was present and Jesus refused to work a miracle to satisfy it?
Hunger.
His own hunger. Command these stones to be made bread, Jesus wouldn't do it. In John 6, 26 following, what human need was present and Jesus refused to satisfy that human need by working a miracle? What?
Hunger
again. They wanted him to make some bread like he had done just previous on the other side of the sea. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. Not going to do it. In Luke chapter 2, verse 23 through 27, look over at that passage. Luke 2, 23. I didn't. It must be Luke 4, 23. I must have written that down wrong. Yeah, Luke 4. I said Luke 2. It's Luke 4. In Luke 4, in verse 25, he said, I say to you in truth, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah when the sky shut up for 3 years and 6 months, when a great famine came over all the land. And yet Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon to a woman who was a widow. There are many lepers in Israel at the time of Elisha the prophet. None of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian. Did all the other lepers in Israel not need a cure? Sure they did. The other widows, wouldn't they have enjoyed a jar of oil that never ended? But the idea that God used miracles always to meet human needs is simply contrary to the facts. Sometimes, as we see on this next point, miracles actually caused physical problems and human need. I've got here Exodus 7 through 12. You didn't even have to look that up, did you? What physical problems and human need did those miracles cause? The plagues. No crops. Loss of animals, boils, death, miracles. And then we've got Acts 13, 9 through 12. What miracle, what problem did the miracle work from that occasion cause? What?
Blindness, Paul.
That's right, blindness. Paul blinded Elymas, did he not? And so, and then here's the point Betty made earlier. God still cares and responds to his children's needs through divine providence and natural law according to his will. And we're encouraged to pray concerning our needs. Matthew 6:11. What is there in that prayer that Jesus was, when he was teaching the people to pray, what did he say? Pray. What phrase did he use about your daily needs?
Give us this day our daily bread.
And we'll satisfy our daily needs. How is he going to do it? I don't know. But pray for it. And God, in his providence, can see that happens. In Acts 12:5, what were the early disciples praying for?
Peter
be released from prison, or at least stand strong in prison. I don't know if they were praying for release. They were surprised when he came to the gate. But they're praying for him in prison. And God had chose to actually set him free. And so these are other examples. Now let's look at Acts 10. Mark was way ahead of me there. He was right. Let's look at Acts 10, 34 and 35. The text says, Peter said, I most certainly understand that God is not one to show partiality or to show respect of person, but in every nation, the man who fears him and does what is right is welcome to him. What contextually is meant by God doesn't show partiality? What? Jews versus Gentiles. Has God ever shown partiality to the Jews? Did God never did? Yeah, I think he did too. So what's he talking about?
Salvation.
Salvation in Christ is it for Jews and Gentiles. But God did show partiality to the Jews. Did he show partiality among the Jews to any individual Jews? Yes. The idea that God doesn't show partiality, this verse doesn't teach that. Don't pick this verse up, you got a sermon to preach, and get God doesn't show partiality and just make any application of it. God does show partiality. But not in the sense of not offering salvation to all men. Lord willing, we'll pick up. Well, that pretty much finishes this sheet. That bottom statement down there. Miracles were used by God to reveal and confirm heaven's message and its messengers. That purpose has been accomplished and these miracles are no longer needed. So we'll just pick up, the Lord willing, in our next class with week 13.